This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football. Still, I understand, the number one podcast in Armenian. That's 2 weeks running, so that's fantastic. So obviously my pronunciation of hello in Armenian last week worked a treat. This is the pod that looks at the money behind the beautiful game. I'm Kevin Day and I'm joined, of course, by football finance expert and the one you're all here for, to be honest, Kieran Maguire. Once again, we've added music.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yep. So, Kieran, do you want to know what's coming up on the pod?
Oh, yes, please.
Well,
yes.
You will do, because I know how much more research you do than I. we're finally getting around to a hot topic for our listeners this week, stadium sales. So a lot of clubs have sold or mortgaged theirs recently, not all of them to themselves. So we'll be asking why they do that and what are the implications. Plus, we got that, finally getting around to that discussion about supporter-owned clubs. We talked a little bit last week about Partick Thistle. We're going to talk about it more this week. And the Youth Development Scheme, a.k.a. EPPP. And, of course, your questions. It is EPPP.
It is EPPP.
I haven't put an extra P in.
No.
Have you had a good week?
I've had a good week. Yeah, very good.
More small print?
Oh, I've been going through it with a fine-tooth comb, as always.
I suspect you genuinely enjoy it, don't you? Now, stadium sales. We've been asked a lot about stadium sales recently, and you've introduced it. It's surprising how many topics stadium sales, the Venn diagram of other football finance topics, it's, you know, stadium sales are in the middle of it because a lot of clubs are doing it. Sheffield Wednesday, Coventry, Northampton, Derby, Brighton. There's a lot of things going on. So are these all for the same reasons? Are clubs selling the stadiums for the same reasons?
No, I think if you look historically, a football club is part of our heartbeat. You know, you grow up as a fan, you've got all of those memories associated with the football club, and therefore it's a community asset. It's something which you would hope would be protected, or if it does disappear, would be replaced by something better.
Who would protect it though?
Well,
you're talking about legally, or morally, you're absolutely right. But I'm just wondering, legally, who would that job fall to?
If football clubs want to be associated with the Football Association, if they want to play in the FA Cup, if they want to be involved on a regular basis in these leagues, why isn't somebody turning around and saying that all transactions involving clubs, mortgages, sales and so on, those have to be scrutinised and approved at FA level?
Because as we know, they're not.
Well, exactly. And that's indicative of the fact that what is the purpose of the FA? And it appears to be, well, nobody's actually quite sure. Yeah. It appears to be, business class trips to foreign shores whenever England play away.
Also, it does mean that somebody from the Cambridgeshire FA gets a jolly old day out to the FA Cup every season, despite not having supported any of the teams involved.
That's right.
A question for another pod.
if you then say, well, what is the biggest opportunity for somebody to make money out of a football club? It would often be connected with the stadium. Now, if I go back to Brighton's situation in the 1990s, we had owners who sold our ground for £7 million. And we thought, well, we're not quite sure how much it's worth, but, you know, land prices in Brighton,
Hove. Its location, that's what the value is.
That's
there,
right, and it was in Hove. Yeah, Hove is where the posh people used to live.
Yeah. Brighton's where the posh people, they're all posh now, we know that. Although I've been told by one particular Palace fan that we shouldn't be talking about the Palace Brighton situation, so let's not delve into the fact that Brighton fans are all posh, and you've all got Labradors.
I've got a setter.
Well, you've got an English setter, it's even posher than a Labrador.
Absolutely. Within a few months, the ground was resold for £27 million.
Resold
to...
Who bought it originally?
It was sold to a property developer,
okay,
who
fine.
Then sold it on. Right. So it then became Toys R Us. And
appropriate.
Exactly.
With your plastic bag kit, should have been a Tesco, surely. Anyway.
So it sold for £27 million within a year. Now that's an awful lot of profit being made awfully quickly. Was it sold too cheaply originally? Somebody's made a lot of money very, very quickly. So that's one particular issue. If we take a look at West Ham and Upton Park. Now, is it Upton Park or is it the bowling ground?
Most West Ham fans didn't get carried away about it. But I'm pleased you mentioned this, because this was going to be one of my next questions, because I didn't know this until what you're about to tell me. Because like many football fans, the London Stadium move seems very iffy. And there's a lot of football fans who think West Ham got a very good deal. And I used to love going to Upton Park forward / the bowling ground. It was a great place to go and watch football, even as an away fan. I mean, it's evening games at the bowling ground, the hairs on the back of your neck would go up. So I'm really upset and angry by what you're about to tell me.
Right. West Ham United, or WH Holding, is their holding company, they owned the ground. The ground was sold for £40 million. To a company called Bowlin Phoenix. And if you take a look at Karen Brady's statements at the time, it was, we sold it to this company. We could have got a little bit more money elsewhere, but we know that these new owners, they're going to preserve the heritage of the club. And it all came across, fair play, David Gold, David Sullivan, you're supporting the local environment, you're supporting the local community. Very impressive. And so it sold to this company called Bowlin Phoenix, which hadn't existed. Okay, this company just sprung up from nowhere.
So it was set up.
It was set up purely for this transaction. So if you go into the small print of their accounts, which, as we know, I like to do, there was the previous year, it had zero sales, zero anything.
Should that ring alarm bells? You know, this is not my world. Would that normally be something to be suspicious about in a brand new company?
You'd ask yourself, where have they got their funding from?
Right.
Yeah, because you and I just can't set up a company and write out a cheque for £40 million because we need £40 million of funding. So that seemed very strange. And
no connection to the club, though, as far as
we know. No connection to the club. Right. I've been through the list of directors, couldn't see anything. I think one of the directors, he was the brother-in-law of one of the directors at Spurs. That was sort of a very tenuous football collection. And then, immediately, it was sold for £60 million to Barrett's. And now there is a development of, I think, about 800 houses where the ground used to be.
Sorry, so they didn't do anything. So this initial company didn't build anything.
Didn't build anything.
They just...
They bought it for £40 million and they sold it for £60 million practically straight away.
So these people have just made 20 million quid?
Yeah.
Out of nothing?
Out of... Well, either they persuaded David Gold and David Sullivan, who, and remember, most people associate Gold and Sullivan with one-handed magazines, but actually, it's that they are pretty clever guys. They've made an awful lot of money from property. So I was surprised that they either sold it at too high a price or too low a price and allowed somebody else to make £20 million on the back of that.
Is this common? I mean, does this happen in another business, that you set up a business and you sell it even though it's done nothing? So this new company now owned the land that the Upton Park is
that's
on.
That's right, and then it immediately sold it to Barrett's. Barrett's knocked down the stadium, and they built. I think it's 838.
And does this new company exist anymore?
It exists in the sense that it's legally there. It's had no transaction since the sale of the stadium. It then paid out a dividend of around about £13 million to the shareholders. It paid a hell of a lot. Yeah, paid about £7 million on tax on the deal, and then effectively it's just disappeared.
That's... I'm reluctant to say it out loud for legal reasons, but it doesn't seem right, does it? And I've not been to the housing development. Is it sympathetic? Do we know? Does it?
I think there is some social housing there. That's down to Barrett's. I think it would be interesting to see what West Ham fans thought of it.
Ayresome Park used to be a place to visit for a South London boy back in the day. But at least I've been to where the houses are now, the development, and at least there is a nod to the history, because there's a little plaque where the penalty spot was, where the South Korean guy scored, the North Korean guy scored the penalty from. So where the goals were is marked out. So it's kind of, you know that you're at somewhere where a football ground used to be. So you would hope at the bowling ground. But I don't think we can leave West Ham without touching on not just the slightly shady situation that you described about leaving Upton Park, but the situation, the circumstances in which they gained the London Stadium, which has been very unpopular for most West Ham fans, for most away fans. They'll never play a game on Boxing Day again at home because of the Westfield Shopping Centre, so on and so forth. It feels like it's not their ground except on every second Saturday. Is that a win-win situation for West Ham? Did they pull a fast one on London and the Mayor of London there? Was that just good business on their part, or did they outflank people who were slightly naive business-wise?
I think it was superb negotiation by West Ham.
Right.
I think if you look at the rent that they're paying, £1.5 million in a stadium that costs £700 million, you do that on a percentage basis.
Yes.
They've got a fantastic deal.
In an area that's been regenerated almost on a daily basis. You go there, each, because of where studios I'm working in, 500 yards from the London Stadium, and each week there's something new. So it's an area that's going to be, it's going to be worth that rent in 3 years' time, will be even more ridiculous.
Yeah. So they've done extremely well. And from a West Ham fan, from a business point of view, you've got to give credit to the owners. From what our romantic notion of football, of steep terraces, being close to the players, we both know that that's not the case. Mm. I've been to the new stadium, and it was bring your opera glasses.
Yes, I know.
And that took it away. There is a very toxic relationship which has waxed and waned since the club moved to the London Stadium. I think a lot of the fans feel, and I'm in some of the fan groups are in contact with me, asking me for more details about the numbers and so on.
Okay.
And I think the thing which was most shocking was that moving from Upton Park to the London Stadium, which was an increase in capacity from around about 35,000 to 57,000, it's now up to 60. They thought, well, lots more money coming in, lots more money for players, lots more money for wages. In the first year of the move, an extra £2 million.
Right.
Now, if you think that for every position in the Premier League, you get an extra going from 13th to 12th, an extra £2 million.
Yeah.
Is £2 million a year better off?
Yeah.
Is that worth all the memories disappearing, all the history and the heritage, all of those people who have now lost their jobs? You know, we're not getting too romantic about the jelly deal shops, I remember the first football match I ever went to, which was, you know, my uncle was a West Ham fan. He took me at the age of 9, and I just remember this incredible experience.
Absolutely.
What an amazing ground, what a fantastic atmosphere. People have lost jobs, people have lost their memories for something which is soulless.
I mean, that's a beautiful description, because they have completely lost the goodwill of the fans, some of the most loyal fans in football. And even as a Palace fan and a proud son of South London, you know, for me, you'd say to people, if you want to get the London experience, go to West Ham. But what's interesting is a friend of mine, it's a West Ham season ticket holder, who says on a game-by-game basis, you never have the same people around you. So clearly, either season ticket holders aren't turning up every week, or the club are selling the season tickets on a weekly basis to tourists. And his other point is, the white seats really show up when people leave early, as many of them are doing.
Yeah.
And the club simply don't play as well as there. It's not their home anymore. But how many? Because I always thought it was way too many. I mean, 35,000 seemed right for West Ham. That's, you know, it always seemed too big a move. An extra 22,000 fans, you always thought was very, very optimistic, even though it's in the east of the London, it's towards Essex. So a lot of these people, presumably, are tourists, are people who are going to one game in their trip to London and spending money at the club at the same day? Or?
Well, this is the really weird thing about West Ham. You know, when the capacity of the ground was 57,000, they actually had 52,000 season tickets.
Did they?
Again, you know, David Golden, David Sullivan, they come in for a lot of stick. The prices were pretty very low,
right,
you know, by Premier League standards.
Okay.
So that could be a part of the reason why they didn't get the big increase that they were expecting. if you compare that to Liverpool, why did Liverpool make a fortune from match day? It's because Liverpool have got a capacity of 54,000 at Anfield, but they only sell 26,000 season tickets.
Oh.
So therefore...
Oh, okay.
Now, last week, I don't know whether you saw this, but Liverpool tickets was trending on Twitter.
Yes, I didn't see it, but you told me about it via one of your interesting emails.
So, I investigated further.
I didn't get to the end of it here, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. And the reason why this was trending is that Liverpool effectively sell match day tickets twice a year. So there's an almighty bun fight for tickets.
So this is a deliberate policy, because Liverpool could sell 54,000 season tickets easily.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a deliberate policy that only half the capacity is kept for season ticket holders.
That's right.
Which already is wrong, as far as I'm concerned.
Because who's going to be buying... So these are for people that are going to get into two or three matches a year. So what are they going to be doing? Well, first of all, whilst there is a lot of criticism about prices of tickets, I would say that most season ticket prices they're not cheap, but I work out my match by match ticket price. It's reasonable when I compare that to the cost of going to a gig or cost of going out for a meal.
And most clubs in the Premier League, you have instalment plans, and
yeah.
So you're not necessarily laying out 600, 1200, 1800 quid.
That's right. It's less than you could be paying for your TV and broadband. Yeah, to go and watch your club and
or for your Brighton fans, your Opera or your
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Cool.
I live near Glynde, by the way.
Of course you do. Where else would you walk the setter?
So how can the club make more money from the fans? If you sell more match day ticket prices are much higher than season ticket prices.
Of course, of course.
And if you're going to a match once or twice a season, you're going to go to Anfield or you're going to go to Old Trafford or wherever it's going to be, you're going to go into the megastore and you're going to spend every last penny that you've got. So this is clever marketing. This is business strategy. This is all the type of nonsense I teach on an MBA course. Yeah. How do you extract the most money out of your punters? But as an old-fashioned football fan, you're going...
I know from experience, because one of my favourite Match of the Day 2 pieces was travelling from Oslo to Anfield with some Norwegian fans.
Yeah.
Who I was meant to meet at lunchtime before the game, but they got barred from the pub. They'd only been there since 11 o'clock. But they were great, but they go four times a year, and one of them gets so drunk that he buys a shirt at the end of the game, and he gets the result and all the scorers printed on the back of the shirt. And they must... Because they were talking about how wages in Norway are quite high. Mm-hmm. They've got a lot of disposable income. One of them was saying they probably spend £1,000 each during the match day experience, 800 quid of which is around Liverpool and
which is great,
but that begs it. So how do these fans get these tickets? Are they in a ballot? Are they?
You've got to
be a member. So presumably you've got to be members. And is it the whole point scheme for each game?
If you're a member of the scheme, I think for four matches, I think if it's for Everton, Manchester United, and a couple of other Chelsea and so on. For four matches, it is on a points basis.
Right.
But the rest of it's a free-for-all. But in order to be able to apply for tickets, you've got to buy into the membership scheme. And I think it's £27. And what does that £27 give you? That gives you the right to queue online tickets with no guarantee of getting a ticket even once a season. Good for cash generation.
How much is the club making out of this then? How many people have signed up to this scheme?
Well, there were over 100,000 people queuing last week. I only picked it up because I was looking at Twitter at the time.
For 26,000 tickets?
For 26,000 tickets, yeah.
So that's 74,000 people paying 27 quid who aren't getting a ticket.
Yeah.
Do you know what disappoints me most about that, apart from everything, is that Liverpool are a club who sell themselves on the special relationship with the fans. I mean, Liverpool, you think of Liverpool, you think of fans, everyone thinks of the... So, but that's not a good way to treat fans, is it? I mean, or is it a fairer way? Because if it's just 56,000 season ticket holders and the rest of the world who love Liverpool never get a chance to go.
You can see it from both points of view.
Right.
And if you do talk to somebody who's got a season ticket at Anfield, they say, I'm perfectly happy.
Oh, okay,
and
fine,
also,
yeah.
If you think about all this extra money coming into the club, that allowed us to apply. So yeah, we signed Mo Salah, we signed Sane, we've signed Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah.
The people who are not in the scheme, we are a bit elitist as fans. You know, as a season ticket holder, I consider myself to be slightly superior to a day tripper, to a football tourist.
Every away fan considers themselves superior to the home fan. Absolutely.
Exactly. You could argue it's sound business sense.
I want to, before we get on to other reasons for selling stadium, i.e. to yourself, alarm bells, or so many stories we hear of clubs in financial trouble start along the lines with, to paraphrase Casablanca, Mr. I sold a stadium once. And that seems to be where so many clubs' problems go, and that they release. At Palace, we had an issue for a long time because we didn't own the freehold to the ground, so you couldn't do anything. But that's a club's biggest asset. Well, I suppose players are the biggest asset, but the stadium is a club's biggest asset by far. And once you buy a club and get rid of that, you're in normally the start of a rocky road, isn't it?
Yeah, because with a player, you can replace a player with somebody from the youth team at zero cost. If you sell your stadium, you've got a problem. So look what's happened to Coventry City. You know, I've been to Highfield Road. You've probably been to Highfield Road.
Yes,
long time ago, yeah. Kids. But the new stadium, it was great when it first came along. But it wasn't owned by the club. The club's then been taken over by a hedge fund in the Cayman Islands called Sisu.
Mm.
Now, Sisu have been trying to buy the stadium. They've been using silver-tongued lawyers to try to force the council to sell it to them at a very low price, and then sell it on with the rest of the club.
Remind, was the stadium, the new place, always owned by the council?
Yeah, I think it was owned by the council, right. But there was a good relationship. And Sisu bought Coventry City. Coventry City were in problems about 2007. I think Ray Ransom was involved at one stage and so on. Sisu bought the club. They underwrote the losses for a little while, and they were trying to persuade Coventry City Council to sell them the ground. For what looked like a knockdown price, the ground was then sold to other people, and Coventry, as a result of falling out with the landlords, are now playing their games in Birmingham. Now, that's not good. It's not good for Coventry City fans. Birmingham will make a bit of money out of it. Yeah. It's not good for away fans as well, because you're going to... Hey, is it a new ground? Is it not a new ground?
Yeah.
Who's making all the money from the merchandise? Who's making all the money from refreshments and so on? That's not going to Coventry City. So it means that the manager's got a problem. He's got a lower budget and so on.
It's such a dispiriting story, Coventry, isn't it? Because I always won those clubs. Like you, going to Highfield Road, there's a pub called The Rocket between the ground and the station that was a brilliant away fans pub.
When they won the FA Cup, I think everybody that day, Keith Houchins, anybody that was there who watched that at the time, when the FA Cup used to be such a big annual experience. What a goal, what a match.
Yeah, but they were a Premier League club. And it's like Charlton, I suppose. It's a salutary lesson to not go chasing what you... You know, to be careful. You know, we have this at Palace. You know, surviving the Premier League is enough of an ambition for most people, because you see, when a club like Coventry or Charlton decides that they should be in Europe, and they start spending money to do that, and then they fall out of the Premier League and they start spending money to get back in, it can be a long, rocky road back financially, can't it?
Yeah, and there's just too many of these stories in relation to the stadium. So we've spoken about Bury at length. But there's something similar has happened at Northampton Town.
Right.
The Northampton owners went to the local council and they said, we want to expand the stadium. And the council said, okay, can we help? So the owners said, we'd like to borrow £10.5 million. Council wrote them out a cheque. From the council. Council wrote them out a cheque. The owners disappeared.
Oh, okay.
along with the money.
I thought there might be something else after that.
No, that was it. Yeah, whoosh.
I've never heard... Is that common for councils to help like that? I mean, that's a spectacular amount of money for a council.
Well, the councils aren't going to put it in... they're not going to be talking about it too loudly, but it's an ongoing issue.
So selling stadiums is one thing.
Yep.
And it seems that football owners are not particularly savvy about selling stadiums. But then we have the issue recently with Sheffield Wednesday and Derby. And I know Sheffield Wednesday fans, the week we started this pod, Sheffield Wednesday fans were a little bit worried because it seemed that the EFL were taking it more seriously than they thought. And since then, the EFL have taken steps and there are potential sanctions. So for those of you, for those people listening who aren't au fait with the story, explain what Sheffield Wednesday wanted to sell, who Sheffield Wednesday wanted to sell the stadium to, essentially.
Right. Sheffield Wednesday's owner is a Thai guy. He's from a tuna background. That's where his family's made the
not
money.
Piano.
Fish, yes.
Yeah.
And he's called Mr. Chansiri. He has underwritten the losses, like all the owners do in the championship. It's very much a vanity project. But Sheffield Wednesday were going to make an FFP loss, or far in excess of the £39 million that's allowed.
Financial fair play loss.
Yeah. So one of the ways you can get around that, and nobody knows why the rules have been changed to allow the clubs to do this, is to sell the stadium. And if you sell the stadium to a third party, as we've seen in relation to West Ham, you know, you can still be a profit, but somebody else potentially can make a lot more money. But what's happened in relation to Hillsborough, that it was sold for £60 million to a company called Sheffield 3 Limited, also owned by Mr. Chansiri. And this was in the 2018 accounts. The problem was that if you go to the land registry, the purchase of Hillsborough wasn't in the land registry until July 2019. Sheffield 3 Limited didn't exist until July 2019.
Right.
And Sheffield Wednesday didn't receive any cash from the sale. Look at the small print. They're going to receive 8 amounts of £7.5 million spread over 8 years. Now, I don't know, have you sold your house? Have you moved house? Well, the one thing you do is you make sure you get the cash.
Yes.
So Sheffield...
I'll check that happened. I'll ask Mrs. Day whether we did actually get... Yes.
So it seems very odd, if you're involved in a land transaction of that nature, why has the other party not paid? So the accusation or the suspicion is that Sheffield Wednesday... didn't realise the extent to which they were in a financial fair play pickle. And the cynics are saying this transaction was engineered a few months later and has been brought forwards. Now, we don't know exactly the nature of the charges from the EFL, but they've said, you know, we've been having ongoing discussions with the club and there are some pieces of paperwork that we're not happy with. So I think the issues are, A, Is 60 million quid an appropriate price for Hillsborough? I've got no idea.
Right.
You've got no idea. Yeah. We're not surveyors.
Yeah, fair point.
And I've also phoned up some big-hitting surveyors.
Yeah.
And they said, we couldn't tell you either. It's very difficult.
Oh, really?
It's a bit... How do you value... How do you value a painting? Yeah, if you've got a Picasso, what is it worth? Nobody knows.
Well, the cliche is it's worth as much as somebody will pay for it, I suppose.
That's
isn't
right.
And
if I'm trying to sell it to you, I'm trying to get as high a price as possible.
Yeah,
you're trying to pay as low as price as possible. If I'm selling it to me, and effectively, what am I doing? I'm taking £60 million from bank account A and transferring it to bank account B.
Yeah.
So I'm not any better or worse off. But Sheffield Wednesday have satisfied financial fair play as a result of that. So that is the nature of the criticism.
I'm surprised that there isn't some kind of... You'd imagine that surveyors would have some kind of table, that at least with a baseline. It's like an estate agent will walk into a house in London, for example, and will know, you know, it's at least £250,000, and each bedroom adds this. So you'd imagine that you know, just the square footage of Hillsborough plus the surrounding, you'd think they would... I'm surprised they've got no indication at all.
Well,
they
use something called the Red Book. So the first thing they say is a bit like what you've just said. If I am buying a house in Walthamstow in London, in a particular road, you look to see, well, what are the other houses in Walthamstow in that road gone for?
Fine, so you can't compare with football grounds.
But with the football grounds,
the
nearest ground that's been sold is Derby County. That's also been sold to a guy who happens to be the owner of the club.
Well, that brings us handily on to that next question. Because what are the before we talk about Derby, what are the ramifications for Sheffield Wednesday? What are the potential threats for the EFL? And does that mean that Derby will be having second thoughts about doing the same thing themselves?
Well, Derby have done it. They've already done it.
They've already done it. Right. Okay.
I think the potential issues are... A, the best case scenario for Sheffield Wednesday is the EFL turn round and say, your paperwork's rubbish. you know, get your house in order. It's a bit like when, you know, if you get the tax man coming to you and say, well, Kevin, you've been claiming some expenses. Have you got the receipts? So, you know, it's something.
Yes and no is the answer to both those questions, unfortunately. Yeah.
So it could be that they say you really need to get your house in order. It's pretty shabby for a multi-million pound business. And it goes no further.
Right.
So that would be ideal scenario. The second issue would be that they could have a transfer embargo. Now, Sheffield Wednesday have had transfer embargoes before.
Okay.
So this makes life tougher for the manager.
Right.
You know, he's got to work with the existing squad. You sign players, they've not turned out to be as good as you thought they are. You've got long-term injuries. You know, and under the terms of the transfer embargoes, it's normally, and this is where we're going to be getting our violins out, if you do sign a new player in the EFL, you can't pay him more than £600,000 a year.
Right.
Yeah. Fans' sympathy, I think, is just gone out that door.
You can't work. Who can work with those parameters?
Well, exactly.
Wow, crikey.
Yeah. But the average wage in the championship is considerably higher than that.
Is it?
Yeah, it's around about 17 grand a week. So that's what, 800?
In the championship?
In the championship.
Wow.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamacq, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Okay.
Yeah. So that would be the second scenario. Sheffield Wednesday have been through that before. Not ideal, but that's, yeah, there's something clubs, quite a few clubs in that division have had to deal with. Third scenario, and I think the one which they fear the most, because they've had a good start to the season, would be a points deduction. Now, we saw Birmingham City last season have a points deduction, and the good thing about that was, I think it was a 46-page judgment. If you go through the small print, which we know establishes it, I have no life. They set out.
Well, to be fair, your life is checking small print. That is what you do for a living, pretty much. So, to be fair, and you teach other people to do it. So it'd be more amazing if I was to be checking the small print, which is again something I probably should have been doing in the past. But so if
you go through the small print, we now know exactly what the tariff is, how much loss to how many points.
There is a tariff then. It's not randomly decided depending on the severity of the case.
Well, there is a tariff, and then in the small print to the small print, they say we have two things. We have one thing is called aggravating factors. If you have deliberately tried to mislead us, we're going to take a stronger stance.
Yeah.
And then there are mitigating factors. And this is what happened with Birmingham. Birmingham was supposed to have, I think, an extra point deducted, but they had a mitigating factor point given back to them. If you have done something good, and Birmingham actually reported themselves to the EFL. When they realised we've done the sums, we've gone out and signed a player, even though you told us not to sign this player.
Right.
But they did report themselves, and therefore the judgment, the committee, who I think it's, you know, senior barrister and you know, people of that nature, you know, pretty learned dudes.
But not football people, just independent.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Would the EFL worry, for example, that Birmingham would be looking at the points deduction, if any, for Sheffield Wednesday, and then saying, well, hang on a second, you should be. Our case was not as bad as that, and they haven't been deducted as many points. Was that an issue as well then?
I think so. I mean, because, you know, whataboutery is part of being a football fan and part of being within football. Full stop.
Yes, yes.
So if you were a Birmingham fan, I think you would feel fairly aggrieved. I think if you were a fan of Middlesbrough, Steve Gibson, the Middlesbrough owner, he has been very vocal on this particular issue. And I think Tony Pulis, when he was the manager, Tony Pulis used to keep on going on about it. So
the issue in general, or about Sheffield Wednesday?
On the issue of the stadium sales and clubs deliberately trying to generate profits. And generating profits from stadium sales is within the rules.
Right.
It's within the EFL rules. It's not within the UEFA FFP rules.
What's your instinct as to what will happen with Sheffield Wednesday?
The EFL have got a new sheriff in town called Rick Parry.
The Rick Parry. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now, Rick used to be head of the Premier League. Yeah. He used to be the chief executive of Liverpool. Rick, 64. You know, the reason why he doesn't need the money. He's a smart guy. He's a successful guy. Why has he come into the EFL? I think it's because he feels that it needs sorting, and he's got the experience to bring to it. So we've got a new sheriff in town who wants to ensure that the rules are being applied appropriately. Just after our last podcast, the EFL advertised for somebody to go in and read the small print of all the clubs. This was actually on a link. I saw this on LinkedIn. So they're offering.
Did you apply?
No.
This is right up your street. This year. Really?
I'd missed the podcast too much.
Oh, bless you. So somebody has now been appointed to read the small print.
They're trying to recruit somebody to go in and check the small print. So it appears that the.
And would clubs have to comply with that?
Yes. Yeah.
It would look bad if you didn't, presumably.
If you don't hand across your accounts for FFP, but I think that's an aggregating factor. Yeah. So what would be the next step? You know, will the clubs take a look at the rules and say stadium sales shouldn't be allowed for FFP, or will they say, well, hold on, effectively Villa, Derby, Reading, Sheffield Wednesday, they've all had the benefit of doing this from financial point of view. So if I am Borough, if I am Queen's Park Rangers or another club in the Championship, surely I should be allowed to do that as well. So we don't know what the reaction of club owners is going to be. But my concern is Sheffield Wednesday do not own Hillsborough anymore. Now, Mr. Chancery, he now owes £60 million to the football club. What happens if he goes bust?
Oh, right, of course.
There are potential ramifications. And fans will say, well, that's not going to be the case. We'll rewind 15 months to Aston Villa's situation, where Dr. Tony, who had been coming across from Hong Kong with suitcases of cash to pay the wages. I mean, you know, the Aston Villa story was absolutely crazy.
Yes.
And when he ran out of cash, that's when things fell apart. Having rich benefactors is great, but sometimes they don't turn out to be quite as rich as they claim to be.
Well, I suppose as well, logically, if Mr. Chancery now owes £60 million, that makes it more likely that he's going to struggle for money anyway, doesn't it? Now, Bernadette Coates, I can only apologise, Bernadette, because you asked us this question a long time ago. Supporters Trust. Now, we touched on it last week a little bit with Partick Thistle, and you explained that in Scotland, because most of the clubs, financially, scale-wise, aren't Celtic and Rangers, there is more scope for supporters to be involved. Bernadette's an Exeter fan, and she has been since moving to the city, and she moved at the time when Exeter had fallen out of the triangle, the league, the pyramid, fallen out of the league. We're in serious trouble, and football fans stepped in, Supporters Trust, saved the club. And basically what she... Because to me, the idea of every football club being run by a Supporters Trust seems to be right, or at least even the German model, when it's like 51% of the club is owned by the fans. But are there downsides to Supporters Trust? Is it just a potentially good thing, or can it go as wrong as any other financial model?
There are good bits and bad bits about it. If you take a look at some of the clubs, so Portsmouth, Portsmouth were treated terribly by a succession of owners who just saw it as an opportunity to do a pass the parcel, make a quick buck, sell on. Taken over the Supporters Trust, they've sold out to Michael Eisner, who used to be chief executive of Disney.
Yep.
If you take a look at Wycombe Wanderers were a fan-owned club. They've just been acquired by two American guys. So why? What are the positives? What are the negatives? The good thing is that as a supporters trust, what you can do is that you can do the right things for the right reasons, in the sense that you want it to be part of the community. If you want to have a policy of recruiting players locally, if you say that we think that wages are too high, you can set a wage cap and stick to that. The downside is the people in the Supporters Trust are good people in the main. Whether they are good business people is another matter. And it's not, doesn't mean that they're bad business people. It could be that they are inexperienced. And you get people involved who the reason why they want to get involved is well-meaning, sort of, but it's because, I've always wanted a green and blue striped away kit, and if I get involved, it's my opportunity to do things of this nature.
Yeah.
If you look at any small club or society, it tends to be run by a dedicated number of small people who are incredibly motivated. Initially, when a supporters trust is set up, there will be dozens and dozens of people involved. And you probably know from your personal experience, within 6 months, you're down to a hardcore of four or five, and you're doing 99% of the work.
Well, you mentioned elites earlier in terms of fans. I've been involved in several supporters trusts and other clubs where it becomes quite plain that some of them very much enjoy the cachet, shall we say, of being, I'm not just a supporter, I'm a member of the Sports Trust Board. So there's an element of that. I'm talking about you, AFC Wimbledon, in the early days. Well, that's understandable, that's human nature. But when you talk about Sports Trust selling to Eisner, for example, or the Wycombe, how many supporters have to be to approve that? I mean, so Sports Trust will set up a board. Because we all know from our own experience of football clubs, you meet some amazingly skillful, judges, lawyers, all sorts of people. But as you say, not necessarily businessmen. But so once the decision to sell Wycombe Wanderers to two Americans is made by how many supporters? Is it
they had to get 75% approval, and they did. So, that seems quite a reasonable. And to be fair to these two American guys, they came to the club, they made a presentation. They were silver-tongued. I mean, they were very, very slick. I've spoken to some of the people from Wycombe on both sides. Some people who are still of caution, what are their motivations here? Why are you selling out? Well, ultimately, if you've got a bunch of well-meaning people, they're not necessarily wealthy, well-meaning people who are running football clubs. And to get to the next level, whatever you mean by the next level. So if you take over a club in the National League and your ambition is to get to League Two and no further, the Supporters Trust will work absolutely superbly.
Okay.
If you want to get to the Championship, where the average losses in the Championship are £20 million a year, well, there's six of us.
Yeah.
I'm a bus conductor. Yeah. I work for the council.
Yeah.
We haven't got that type of money. And then along, but I've heard of somebody from America, somebody from Thailand, somebody from China who has got a big checkbook. And if you don't sell out to those people, you're going to have people going, well, hold on. Joseph Schmuckelberger III, from Texas, and he's saying he wants to buy our club, and you're just keeping it because you want to be on the committee and you want to have the other directors come to the directors' box and you want to choose next year's away kit.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you're getting abuse, and we know we live in a society now that abuse isn't just at matches, it's on social media, it's to your kids and so on. We're living in a very different society.
Well, one last question on this before we move on, and we do have to time-wise, unfortunately. I'd be quite pleased if Joseph Schmuckelberger III was to take over. But say, for example, Joseph Schmuckelberger III goes to Wycombe and he offers them £20 million. Where does that money go? Because to be a member of the Supporters Trust, you've paid 10 quid, essentially.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean that the members of the Supporters Trust are now getting a massive windfall, does it?
No. I think what would happen under those circumstances, and you have to be very careful here, because you look, see what happened at Swansea. where Swansea effectively had a supporters trust, and some of the senior guys there walked away with a lot of money when Swansea were acquired by two Americans in 2012, 2013, whenever it was. You've got to look at the constitution. Ideally, any money should go into the club's bank account and should be used for infrastructure, recruitment, wages, local community schemes, and so on. But, if the constitution isn't written the right way, somebody's got opportunity to make money.
But it's strange because those constitutions are written up at a time of crisis, aren't they? At short notice, when your club may not exist, so you're not always necessarily thinking ahead to put that through. Now, Bernadette, it's a good week for Bernadette Coates, because as we took so long to answer her first question, I thought it was only fair to answer another of Bernadette's questions. And I apologise to all of you who have sent in questions, most of which were about your Blackpool nightclub exploits.
They were, actually,
to be perfectly honest. But Bernadette Coates, this is EPPP, which used to be youth development, basically. So this is now Elite Player Performance Plan. Bernadette articulates something, an instinct that a lot of us have, which is, and you'll explain what it is, but it seems somehow that it's not good for lower league clubs, that it's skewed towards the Premier League clubs, the EPPP.
EPPP works as follows. Under the old rules in terms of academies, there was the famous 90-minute rule, so that a club could not recruit a young person if they lived further than 90 minutes away from the training centre. And everybody accepted that. And that was good, because if you were in Exeter, that meant that you had all of the local kids coming to the Exeter Centre of Excellence.
Yeah, there was always some dispute about whether Dublin counted as 90 minutes away from... There was arguments about... The circle around Liverpool and Manchester was argued over quite extensively, wasn't it?
And silver tongue lawyers were involved at the end.
You amaze me.
My mates. The Premier League then went to the EFL and they said, every year we are giving you money in what is referred to as solidarity payments.
All right. Sounds good.
And that's good. Yeah. And in the Championship, it was around about $2.5 million. In League One and League Two, we're talking hundreds of thousands. So that's good. We don't have to give you that money. But here's a suggestion. We will put it in writing. We will put it into a contract that we will guarantee you a percentage of the domestic TV monies every year if you agree to EPPP. And the way that EPP works as follows. First of all, the 90-minute rule is gone.
Yeah.
Secondly, You've mentioned John Bostock in the past,
yes,
who was best, a very, very talented young player.
The best teenager I've ever seen in a Palace, without a doubt.
Yeah. We will give you a fixed amount for a young player. Now, that's £3,000 if they are 10 years old per season.
If they're 10?
If they're 10.
They're buying 10-year-olds.
They can buy 10-year-olds. Well, they can't. They can't buy 10. If he's been in your academy since 10. So we sign him at 16. They've said, we're going to have four tiers of academy. So you've got category 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Yes.
And you will be inspected. Yeah. You will be categorised. And you've got to be able to offer the following in order to go up from one category to the next. So if you are a tier 4, if you've been for a club for 5 or 6 years, you start off, if they started off at a year when they were 10 years old, you get £3,000 for that year, £3,000 when they're 11, then it goes up to £4,500. So therefore everybody knows how much money the Premier League club is going to have to pay, compared to some of the transfer fees for 16 year olds prior to EPP. These sums of money were quite low.
So
the good news for the lower league clubs is that they are now guaranteed these solidarity payments from the Premier League. The bad news is, if you're at Accrington, if you're at Exeter, if you are Leighton Orient, a Premier League club can come in and see one of your young players and say, well, you've been at the academy, we can't sign you until you're 16, but at the age of 16, we can offer you a contract. And we know it's going to cost us £50,000, £80,000.
Right.
And in an age where 16 and 17 year olds potentially can be going for tens and tens of millions. Right. You've only got to look at, you know, some of the fantastic youth players coming through. It does mean that the Premier League teams, you know, their part of the deal is we can now cherry pick your best players, yeah, so they, and pay you a relative pittance.
They've blackmailed lower league clubs, essentially. You get this money if you agree to not have this money, essentially.
That's right, it's a trade-off.
Well, so does this imply then that these rules are strictly adhered to? So take a case where Accrington, as you've mentioned, have got a really good 14-year-old, and United have noticed, and Liverpool have noticed, and Everton have noticed. Are parents still being spoken to? Are people being offered? Are there ways around this, or do United, Liverpool, and Everton? Does Accrington then decide which of those clubs will pay them £12,000 for their biggest asset? Or
no, that would be the choice of the, because he's not a professional footballer, so therefore he's not signed a professional contract with the club itself. He's only on junior terms. That young individual would then, at the age of 16, have the choice of going wherever he wanted to go.
So the old days, the John Bostock days of people being offered cars, parents being offered houses, that's gone, has it?
That would be against the rules.
So it hasn't gone then. I could tell by the way you waited to answer the question.
There are rules.
We know we're only into pod 8, 9, whatever it is, and we know already how many rules are flouted out there.
I'm hoping to speak to a parent of a club, of a young player at a club soon.
Really?
And we'll have that on the pod.
I would. That would be fantastic. That would be really good.
Yeah.
Oh, that's. How do you get to know? You just did this great web of intrigue.
Well, the price of football email account is we're getting some amazing people phoning us up to say, we like the show, which is fantastic. Yeah, we all say thank you very much. But B, did you know this? So I've been contacted by a parent of a club, parent of a player.
I really would be interested to hear that, and there will be strict anonymity, I imagine. But you're a force for good in the football world, aren't you?
I'm just a force for small print.
Let me finish. I want to finish with one final question. This is a question we had on Twitter from Body's Buddy. Not normally at home to rugby, but it is germane. The Saracens are in a lot of trouble for smashing the rugby wage cap. So basically, Buddy's question is about, would a salary cap work in football? My guess is that football clubs in the Premier League would simply not agree to any sort of salary cap. But is it something that we should be looking at signing up to?
I don't think it should work. Ultimately, you're talking about young working class men who are being offered huge sums of money. I've got no issue with that. There's not a salary cap in banking. There's not a salary cap in music. There's not a salary cap in art. So why is this envy against football players? The clubs in the Premier League are not blackmailed into paying these wages. They do so willingly. They can usually sell the player on for a huge sum of money, as we've seen over many summers. So I don't think it would work. If you look to see what's happened in rugby, there's a salary cap in rugby. Initially, the first thing that happened was that players started going to France.
Right.
So if there's a salary cap in English football, players will just go on to the continent if they could be played as money elsewhere.
What was the logic behind the salary cap in rugby? Was it to be more competitive? Like in the NFL, as we know, bizarrely for a very capitalist country, is a very equal business. I mean, they make sure that all clubs are competitive. They all get a share of the merchandise. The worst teams get the first pick of the best players and so on. So was that the idea in rugby?
That was partly it. It was also that rugby clubs, the TV rights for rugby are pretty paltry compared to football. Clubs were losing an absolute fortune.
Oh, right.
And club owners, as we know, all leagues are controlled by club owners.
Yes.
They got together and said, we can't afford to do this.
Okay,
Let's have a salary cap. Right. Let's stop this craziness, because agents are playing players off, you know, from one club to another.
Yeah.
And they said, that's going to work. And then all the players disappeared to France.
Well, it's interesting you say that about players' wages. Why should players' wages be bad? Because I think, as we established when we had our agent friend on, most football fans, it's the agent they blame, not the player. No, most football fans don't begrudge player. There are people of my dad's generation, for example, who simply can't get their head around the actual figure. But most people go, yeah, fair enough. If I could play football that well, I'd ask for that sort of money. Robbie Williams asked for that sort of money to sing songs. Graham Norton gets a lot of money for doing that, so why not? So there isn't that resentment. It seems to be more outside football that people look at the players' wages and go. And I think the class issue, and again, this is for another pod, I think the class issue is absolutely right. I think it is because people think, how are these young working class kids earning that sort of money?
Well, that's right. I mean, the very fact that when we talk about footballers' wages, we talk about them in terms of how much per week. Well, that's an old blue-collar way.
Yeah,
whereas somebody such as myself would say, well, my annual salary is because I'm a white-collar worker.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
So, you know, it's quite insidious that has become so ground in with us. Because if you talk to somebody about the NFL, they will say he's on so much per year. And the NFL is amazingly transparent in terms of players' wages. But with football, it's all to do, you know, you're working class, and it's you do not deserve this because you are from a working class background.
That's really interesting. We will do a class-based pod within the next few weeks. We'll both get it off our chest and we'll get it off our shoulders, which is where the big problem is. Thank you again, Kieran. The agenda I scribble on my piece of paper, we went nowhere near that, pretty much. We just go off where you take us, but it's always worth going. Price of Football is Adaptit production. It's produced by Guy Kilty and it's recorded at Soho Radio. Thank you for listening and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.